Accession number 28361, reel 45.
General Julian Thompson, reel 45. You were saying that you could get two companies worth effectively under each LCU.
Yes, you could get two companies. Mm. So you could, with all the extra bits like mortar platoons, machine gun platoons, you could actually take a battalion in four LCUs.
And you've got the Intrepid coming down.
Intrepid coming down, so we've got eight. So you can land two battalions or commandos simultaneously.
If you get the beach space, presumably.
If you've got the beach space. And the way you did that, I'm going to come on to that, was by having separate beaches. Mm. And the other thing we worked out, and we practiced it, was using the CVRT, the in the bows of the landing craft, so that they were sufficiently high so that they could actually, if you lowered the ramp just a touch, they could shoot over the ramp. And so if there was any enemy on the beach who was causing trouble, in the bows of each landing craft, which provided if you, a sort of armoured stop for the chaps behind, if we were going to have an opposed landing, and in fact in the end we didn't, but that was something else we worked out. Was the
CVRT could give you suppressive fire. Did the CVRT practice landing while you were at Ascension?
Yes, they practiced rolling ashore on the beach and coming off. That's all they could do.
Did they? Mm.
Yeah, that's all they could do. There was a sandy beach and no exit. Mm. There was a cliff behind
them. Were they able to fire their weapons?
They were not able to fire their weapons in Ascension because there was no way of getting them ashore.
Ah. What did they have?
We had scimitars and we had this. What was the other one? There was one that had a 37mm cannon,
yeah.
And there was one that had a 75mm gun.
Mm, yes, the Raden was the 37mm.
They had a Raden, and there was one that had an APDS
75. Yes.
And we had, I had eight of them, so there was one per landing craft.
Mm.
And they, of course, had to be loaded.
Yes.
Before we finally sailed from Ascension. And they were loaded in the LCUs and they travelled south
they
from Ascension in the well
yeah.
of the landing craft, yeah.
And these were household
these were household carriers, Blues and Royals, yeah.
Now you're mentioning giving the Paris some training in amphibious landing. How did they take to that?
Fine. I mean, they referred to the landing craft as rubbish skips. And they knew they were going to have to do that. I mean, there was no, as far as I know, sort of grinding on about it.
No, I know that Tupara had trained previously for amphibious assault. In fact, they'd done it, I think, in 1958.
Oh, yes.
So it wasn't anything.
They'd done it in 1956,
yes.
Actually.
Yeah, 56 and then 58.
It wasn't something the actual people hadn't done it.
No, the people hadn't done it, but the regiment
had done it.
They were presumably ready for anything, as they say.
Yes, you drink preparators, yes.
Mm, mm.
So there was no problem about that. Mm. The problem we had was that two para didn't come down until 24 hours before we sailed. They arrived in the Norland, and they never had a time for a night rehearsal, because we put everyone through it day and night. Then they didn't have they did one run through by day, and then they had to sail.
So two para had to do that. Three para, presumably, were better.
They had done it time and time again. Anyway, in the middle of this, we suddenly got a signal from Northwood saying, stand by to sail at once. I mean, while we were all over the place, you know, chaps training ashore, and I had to bring everyone back.
Mm.
The Rapiers had just landed, and a team had just flown out from the UK with drones and instructors from Lark Hill to put them through their paces.
Mm.
When we would coal by Northwood, load and sail now. Mm. This was, and we sent a signal saying, if we sail, we'll be in an even worse state than when we first arrived.
Mm.
And it took a lot of persuading to stop them from doing it.
Mm.
And eventually we persuaded them, but the opportunity to train the Rapiers was lost.
Mm.
Because we lost, you know, sort of 48 hours arguing the toss over this, and other things had to go.
Mm.
And in fact, it was wrong of me. I should have let that go on. Anyway, at the end of 3 weeks, towards the end, we had finished our planning process and prepared our preferred options, and Jeremy Moore came out on the 29th of April and we presented to him our plan.
How many options did you have?
Three.
And then
well, actually there were four, but we discarded two of them. Let's do the early discarded ones first. We had two plans. I know you can't see this on the tape, but maybe it helps to discuss it.
Of course.
Which were on the predicated on the basis that the Argentines wanted to surrender, but they wouldn't do so unless it became obvious we were going to land. In other words, it was a face saver. And that involved landing here in Barclay Sound or in Cow Bay, Volunteer Bay.
Just the northern part of the peninsula.
Stanley. In other words, you were landing close enough to make it plain that you were landing. There were huge disadvantages landing there because you were too close. You were within gun range and all that sort of thing. And secondly, this is a terrible place because of weather and exits. And you then have to go across this bit here. And I've actually visited that since, and thank God we never even dreamt of landing there.
So Cow Bay is difficult to land on, and it's too far from the objective.
It's too far from the objective.
You've got to walk all the way around the north side of the Barclay Sound.
Exactly.
And then down the neck to actually get onto the Stanley.
Exactly. Peninsula. And the other one was this, it was landing here.
Barclay Sound, within range of artillery.
Within range of enemy artillery, and at all the disadvantages that's giving. Then our preferred option was San Carlos Water here, with a backup option of Port Salvador here. Now, the disadvantage of Port Salvador is you can't get anything bigger than an ASL through that entrance.
It's too narrow
and too shallow, the water. Therefore, you've actually got to unload LPDs and their landing craft here, which is subject to weather.
That's the exposed north coast.
The exposed north coast. And therefore, you're going to... Your build-up is going to be slow because of the transit time through there.
What about helicopter flying?
Okay. Mm. But again, we were not... Our helicopters were becoming our secondary means of landing because we had so few.
Yeah.
And I'll come on to that in a minute. And we didn't have an LPH, and therefore it's off one-spot decks, which is a great limitation. So our favourite was that. So our favourite became that, with that as a very, very much second option. And the other disadvantage of that is there's far more high ground round it, which you're going to have to dominate if you're not going to be putting your neck into the noose. Whereas this
Port
place,
Salvador, whereas San Carlos, you've got...
You can get onto the high ground quickly and dominate it. Mm. And there are a lot of good beaches here, at least four, coming back to your point about numbers of beaches and therefore your build-up rate. There are at least four or five beaches here.
And you're sheltered because you're in the sound or off the sound.
You're sheltered, you can land, doesn't matter what, you can be blowing a force 12 outside and you're in there and you can still go on.
On the other hand, from the point of view of the shipping, you're rather constrained for manoeuvring with them, aren't you?
No, there's quite a lot of room in there. It's quite
there
a big... San Carlos water is actually quite a big piece of water, actually.
So it wouldn't be like shooting fish in a barrel.
Oh, no.
Enemy air forces.
Enemy air force, yes, it is slightly like shooting fish in a barrel, but ships can manoeuvre. They're not stuck there. I mean, you could take Canberra in to there, and it's quite a large stretch of water. You can steam up and down and at full speed, and ships can be manoeuvred. Also, it's difficult to attack by submarine because there's a narrow entrance there which you can dominate. Mm. You can't attack ships in there by exocet. Ships off beaches here could be attacked by airborne exocet. Mm. But you couldn't attack ships there with exocet.
Would it be because the clutter?
Because the ground would decoy the exocet. Because exocet goes for the biggest target. Yeah. And there's so much clutter there, there's absolutely no way you could attack it by exocet.
Yeah. It sounds as though by this stage you knew a great deal more about the enemy.
Right, well, I'll tell you why we knew.
Artillery and enemy forces.
We knew a great deal more about the enemy. A, because I think GCHQ had done a lot of intercepts. And then we'd done our own intercept work ourselves in this sense, in that my G3 Int, who's a crafty fellow, happened to be in the GCHQ shack, which is in Ascension. Ascension is one of the principal GCHQ listening posts. And he discovered, thanks to a chap called Nick Vanderbaal, who was the Int warrant officer, that the Argentines were being allowed to send one welfare telegram per soldier back home, which was done in clear.
Over the radio?
Well, it was done by sort of cable and wireless.
Yes.
but it was done in a way that could be intercepted by GCHQ. Could be picked up. And you can actually pick up quite a lot from 11,000 I'm OK mum telegrams, because they gave away quite a lot of information about units, locations, by inference. Not, you know, I'm sitting at grid reference, blah, blah, blah. Initially, they couldn't give grid references. I'll come back to that in a minute. From those 11,000 welfare telegrams, we were able to build up a picture of their orbit.
Who did the analysis?
My intelligence. Well, what happened was
an enormous amount of work.
The GCHQ boys were going to send it all back to GCHQ, and then they were going to tell us.
Yes.
And my int guy said, bollocks to that. Mm. Give me the telegrams, and we'll do it. Mm. And he and his intelligence guys went through every single one.
How many were there in his team?
Well, he had an enhanced team of about... He had about five or six guys, and we bumped them up with some extra chaps as sort of, you know, cooks and bottle washers. Mm. But they were able to get a huge amount of information out of this, and it was quite interesting, actually. And also, we were getting GCHQ other intercepts of other traffic. I mean, what we didn't know.
Would that be encrypted material between headquarters?
Probably. I mean, I don't know. We didn't need to know where they just sent a signal saying, you know, the 11th Infantry Battalion is located at. It didn't give us their layout, of course. It merely said they were in Stanley.
Yeah.
And that in Stanley there are 15 CCAT missile or type missiles, and that they've got 155 guns. They got the wrong kind of 155s. It was only when we captured them they realised they had a range of 24 clicks. We thought they had a range of 17. It gave their artillery, which they had a great amount, more than we did, it gave strengths and equipment available, though not where it was. I mean, it didn't tell us where their Skyguard radar was, for example. But we were beginning to build up this picture, and the picture was telling us that there isn't much there. In fact, there isn't anything there.
Nothing in San Carlos?
No. Which is another reason for going there.
Was there monitoring also of the Falkland Islanders CB? Because might have picked up quite a lot of stuff from their chatter.
I think, I mean, whether we did, I don't know. I mean, we didn't do it. I'm sure GCHQ did.
Yes.
I'm sure they did. But in the end, of course, the Falkland Islanders were forbidden to use their citizens' band radio by the Argentines for that, presumably, that very reason, except in an emergency.
Yeah, same reason that you didn't want your guys making contact.
Exactly, yeah.
You've got your INT team. Presumably they were also on the Fearless with you.
Yeah, like they're in Lies Another Story.
I was going to ask you, what facilities you actually had for your command and control activities on the Fearless?
In the Fearless, there was a thing called the Amphibious Operations Room, which was designed for the Landing Force Commander to command from, and the Amphibious Force Commander to command from as well. Though he had to spend a lot of his time in the operations room of the ship, because that had the radar displays and the means of controlling the boat lanes and the means of controlling helicopters. So he had to commute from one room to the next room.
He was shuttling then.
He was shuttling. Mm-hmm. In my room, there was a desk at which I could sit, which usually was occupied by my BM. I didn't sit there a lot. Or the duty staff officer. Then behind me, there was a thing called the Supporting Arms Coordination Table, which the gunners, the fixed-wing aviators, the helicopter guys, and the naval gunfire support guys all clustered round, making sure that you didn't fly helicopters down lanes and going to be shot down and all that sort of thing. And then you had the loggies at another table, and then you had other staff, communicators and so forth. So it's a room about the size of this, I suppose.
It's a lot of people in a
very confined space.
What about map boards and display screens and things of that sort?
We didn't have screens, because screens didn't exist. You had a big situation map board, one end, which the BM, the ops boys, were looking at, which was updated all the time by a marine, you know, with China graph.
So and the traditional map with talc overlay.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and a greased pencil scribbled on it.
Yeah, no screens. Yeah. Mm. On the SAC table, there was a map as well. Mm. And on that was drawn things like helicopter approach and retirement lanes, where the cap stations were. The AOA, the Amphibious Operations Area, Assault Area, is a box, three-dimensional box, in which you control everything, and you control airplanes in and out of it, helicopters in and out of it, and it goes up to a certain height. Well, what Mike did to avoid any confliction with our own fighters was it was a low-ceilinged box, so they could be outside it or over it at a certain height and wouldn't be shot down by mistake by us. And helicopters were allowed to fly in and out of it, provided they were under 100 feet.
That's quite low.
Oh, yeah. They used to fly very high. I'll come back to that. Mm. So the aim was that anything that was flying above 100 feet, approaching at a high speed, was an enemy.
And below a certain
height.
Mm. Do you recollect how high the
I think the box was something like 9,000 feet or something like that. Yeah. Something like that.
So you've got your combat air patrol above that.
Yeah.
Below that, you've got your air defence.
Yeah.
Monitoring.
Yeah. Sure. Mm. And going back to the AOR, and in the AOR, of course, is the brigade command net. Mm. So you're talking to, when it's working, we'll come back to that. Mm-hmm. what you have to remember, though, is the LPD has two roles. One is as a command ship and also as a landing ship dock. Mm-hmm. So it has to position itself where it can do two things. One is act as the command post, and B, act as the ship controlling the landing craft, and so you don't want it 10 miles away.
No.
And so it's actually, like all these things, there's a conflict. Mm. In fact, it's better to have a command ship which is not a landing ship, which can go where it likes, where the comms are best.
Mm. 1944, I think most divisional headquarters were actually in destroyers.
Correct.
Offshore.
And brigade headquarters.
Yes. Rather than having...
Exactly. And we used to have a destroyer command ship called the Mion, but, you know...
It had gone.
Mm. Like all these other things, it had gone. Mm. We were talking about command control. Now, we're talking about intelligence, an example of peacetime bad lessons learned. The intelligence office allocated was about the size of two broom cupboards joined together next to the ops room. And quite early on, I said to the captain of Fearless, I need a bigger space. And it took me quite a long time to, you know, I could have, through Mike, ordered him to do it, I suppose, but there was a great deal of foot dragging, and I was eventually given half of what they called Wardroom 2, which was the sort of second wardroom they used as a backup wardroom, which provided us with a space about, I suppose, half the size of this room, but that was big enough. And he suddenly realized, because my and the Commodore's intelligence chaps were starting to produce some really good intelligence, that how well worth it was having this space allocated. What amused me years later was to read about the first Battle of the Falklands, 1914, when Admiral Sturdee, because there was no intelligence facility in HMS Invincible, gave over his day cabin for intelligence collation. That was in 1914. And we were still relearning the lesson in 1982 that you need space in which to collate your intelligence.
Human nature doesn't change.
No. No.
And where did you get these additional intelligence chaps?
We got them sent out. We got them sent out. They were INT Corps chaps who were sent out. And also Mike asked for a chap to just cover air intelligence. So he got sent out, a Royal Air Force chap who was actually a buccaneer backseater but was also an intelligence guy, so he was continually, I mean, though Mike knew about as much as it was possible to know about air, he wanted a chap working on just that, producing air threat assessments.
So he was an observer, presumably.
He was an observer, I mean, he was a navigator in RAF terms. Sorry, I've had a very bad cough, my throat. But it'll keep going, right? I keep lubricating it.
what sources were your main sources for at this time? You mentioned GCHQ, presumably sending you a lot of SIGINT and conclusions. And you've got your own local sources. Were the SAS and SBS giving you a good start by this?
The SAS and SBS, of course, couldn't start until the 1st of May, which is when the carrier battle group approached the island.
And they could then deploy.
They could then deploy. So from about the 2nd on, they were starting to be landed. We were beginning to get information back from about the 4th or 5th. But the SAS had
This was after you had made your plan, though, wasn't it?
This was after we'd made our plan, based on the assumption that we would get certain. I mean, we were prepared to change it,
yeah.
But the framework was like that.
But again, it's in terms of the way you're supposed to do it formally, it's putting the cart before the horse.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So the intelligence was confirmatory, it wasn't initiatory.
Exactly. Because by that time we had enough GCHQ intelligence to show us where the centre of gravity of their forces were. And then, based on that, we were able to task SAS and SBS patrols to go and look at those places and tell us what was actually there and where it was and what its morale was like, what it was doing, and so on.
Was the GCHQ in general right? Had they got the plot?
Yeah.
Or bad?
Pretty well. I mean, I'll come later as to how we got the detailed plot, which we didn't get to a long time later.
And the thing is that you can get the Orbat, but the deployment notoriously can shift.
Absolutely.
Can shift overnight. In
other
words, if they had done their own estimate of your likely behaviour, they might very well have decided to put some observation at the very least on St. Carlos.
Well, they did. Yeah. I'll come back to how we found that out. the problem was communicating the information back. The SAS had acquired, in quotation marks, some SATCOM telephones, which were quite new toys in those days, but they could talk direct to Mike Rose or back to London on those. But that meant they could send back information, real-time information, quickly and securely. The poor old SBS with their HF sets couldn't. They were
going back to the centre then.
Yeah. They were forbidden to transmit anything unless it was an emergency, because they'd be DF'd. So they had to be extracted and briefed face to face. So that added to the time it took. What happened was, we obviously concentrated a lot of SBS effort in San Carlos. We had about 3 patrols in there.
Yeah.
And one of the things they did was reported that it was about a company being moved into Port San Carlos.
Yes.
So that meant there were some enemy there. Mm. And that's one of the reasons why we couldn't do any beach recces of the beaches there. There was an SBS patrol there, which had a hairy time when suddenly a helicopter appeared and put one wheel on their OP, because it was on a hillside like that. Luckily, they put one wheel, started disgorging troops. Well, they were sort of destroying their codes and starting to smash up their radios when the helicopter went away and the troops disappeared.
How did these troops get out? Were they abseiling out of the...
Well, no, the helicopter was doing a classic one where if you've got a hill like that, you put one wheel on the hill, door side, and the guys just jump out.
Onto the hillside?
On the hillside.
But they didn't interfere with the OP?
Didn't see it. Because how we made the OPs and how the SAS and SBS made, they used to take chicken wire ashore with them, which they carried in there, rolled up. And you dug a hole in the peat. Then you laid chicken wire over the hole, and then you put
peat on
the chicken wire. So you lay in this hole, which you looked out, there was a slit about that size.
Yeah.
And this helicopter put a wheel on the chicken wire. And of course, you didn't. You only put the wheel on to steady yourself, like pushing against the wall, while the guys all jump out, and then it went away. Anyway, it blew the turves off, some of them, but luckily the Argentines weren't sufficiently alert to see that.
Was this in daylight?
Daylight.
They didn't notice the turf flying.
No. And they went anyway. They survived. They stayed there until they were extracted. They also reported when they got back every day. Pucaras being escorted in by C-130s. Pucaras are the counterinsurgency turboprop twin engine airplanes, and they were being brought in by C-130s to here and here. And then the C-130 would turn around and fly back to Argentina.
They were going into Stanley, and they were also going into the
Pebble Island.
Yes.
So they reported
air reinforcements
coming in all the time when they got back. These guys reported that the enemy was there.
On the north side of...
On the north side there. There was about a company there. So
What was the company doing? Were they digging in?
Well, no.
Were
the company we then discovered, not from them, because they couldn't see them, had half the company on a place called Fanning Head.
Yes.
Which overlooks this place with a 105 millimetre anti-tank gun.
So that's the entry to San Carlos.
San Carlos. Yes. And I'm going ahead of the story a bit. We discovered them exactly where they were because we were sent out a rudimentary and very early, what do you call it, heat, which detects things at night with heat.
Thermal imager.
Thermal imager. Mm. And it was a bloody great thing about the size of that chair mounted on a tripod. And it was stuck in, and we stuck it in
like
a helicopter.
A searchlight, wasn't it? The only
it was like a bloody great searchlight. Yeah. And it was stuck in this helicopter pointing out of the door.
Mm.
And the Sea King flew a circuit at night. This is when we were close. I mean, we were then on the approach. Mm. So I'm going ahead of the story. And it picked out exactly where there was a team of guys. We suspected there was something. And what we had planned to do was to land an SPS patrol, two patrols, and by helicopter somewhere here, to go and with naval gunfire support to harass them, keep them busy while we were approaching.
Were the SPS capable of directing naval gunfire?
No, they had naval gunfire. They were, but they also had an NGSFO with them.
Ah, right.
And NGSFOs were regarded as being SF. They were trained to exit from submarines. They were trained to parachute. They were trained to go in beforehand.
Mm.
So we had NGSFO parties inserted in here before we landed.
Now, they used to be called Forward Officer Bombardment,
yeah,
didn't they?
They're now called Naval Gunfire Support Forward Observers.
Yeah. And do they train with the SBS to get acquire these skills?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm going ahead of the story, but we then discovered where these guys were situated because their little blobs appeared on the thermal imaging. Mm. And we were able to...
be the human beings.
The human beings, and you had to make certain that they weren't sheep.
Oh, how do you do that?
Well, the only way you could do that was that the sheep tend to not to be sort of in defensive positions.
Ah, yes. So these chaps were dug in?
These chaps were dug in, overlooking Fanning Head.
They got one anti-tank gun.
They got one anti-tank gun, which could have caused quite a lot of damage to a landing craft.
Mm, it could, yes.
And I'll come back to how we dealt with them in the story, but I'm going ahead of it. What I'm saying is that the SF were bringing us back some very valuable information, and they brought us back the information we wouldn't have known that these guys were there unless they told us.
Did they give you any useful stuff about the deployment around Stanley?
The SAS gave us some information on some of the outer positions near Mount Kent, which is sort of here around Stanley, but they weren't able to give us, you know, there's a rifle company dug in here with a frontage of here, and there's another one back here. Mm. It was just pretty general stuff, quite frankly. So all this information is coming back. We have given Jeremy Moore our plan, and he goes back. And at this stage, Sandy Woodward is a bit worried about the lack of success in whittling down the Argentine Air Force, and sends a signal.
Well, there hadn't been any, had there?
Well, there had been, because Sandy had arrived here on the 1st and done bombardments on Stanley. He'd attacked Stanley Airfield as well as the Vulcan attack. They'd been attacked by Sea Harriers, and he'd been bombarding here and Goose Green in daylight, and what he was trying to do was to simulate pre-amphibious landing operations, and that caused the Argentine Air Force to come out, and they had a hell of a fight that first day. They shot down a lot of aeroplanes.
Was that all part of the plan that he had concerted with you, or was he doing that off his own bat?
So he said that was what he'd do.
Oh, he told them he was
going to do that. Yeah, but he was simulating them from his landing to try and draw the Argentine Air Force out. What resulted was they did come out like a hornet's nest, and he realised that he mucked around doing that in daylight too often, and he wasn't going to end up with any ships.
Well, he might lose too many of his own aircraft.
That's right. So one day of that, and that was enough.
Mm.
They then
moved east rapidly.
Rapidly, and then only came in at night to bombard, because the Argentines didn't have a very good night capability.
Mm. Do you think that the Argentines were deceived by that?
No. There were no amphibious ships around.
Oh.
So they weren't deceived by it, and they knew perfectly well that the amphibious ships were still sitting back at Ascension.
How did they know that? Did they have
satellite
reconnaissance
I think they knew it, and in any case they were told it by the Secretary of State for Defence on the 6th of May, when we finally sailed from Ascension Island, when
on the news.
on the news. Mm. When Mike Clapp made great efforts to leave behind radio stations and radio operas sending the sort of traffic we've been sending from there all the time, based ashore, and we heard to our surprise that even the Secretary of State for Defence saying the amphibious task group has now sailed from Ascension Island.